I don't know what possessed me, but in that moment, I just had this idea and I blurted it out to him in the elevator. I said, Alfred, my name is Steve Herz. We met a few months ago. I just quit my job yesterday and I want to start my own business. And I'd like to start it with you because I really know the sports television business now, having worked in it for the past several years, and you know the news business. I think we could do really well together. I don't want to work for anybody anymore. I want to be on my own, but you'd be a great partner. And he must have been like, who the hell is this guy? But to his credit, we as we got out of the elevator, he turned back to me and he said, here's my card. Be in my office tomorrow morning at 8 a.m.
That's how success happens. From Entrepreneur Magazine, my name is Robert Tuckman. I self-funded, built up, and eventually sold two businesses to major players in the sports and entertainment industry. And I am fascinated by other entrepreneurial minds and what drives high-achieving people. So on this podcast, we're going to learn what they've learned and what it takes to really succeed. Steve Herz is definitely one of the most fascinating people I know. He's the president of the Montag Group, a sports and entertainment talent and marketing consultancy. Prior to joining TMG, Steve was the president and founding partner of IF Management, an industry leader whose broadcasting division became one of the largest in the space, representing over 200 television and radio personalities. The agency represents some of the biggest names in sports and news media, including NBC's Sports' Mike Tirico, ESPN's Scott Van Pelt and Dan Shulman, as well as CNN's chief international correspondent, Clarissa Ward. But Steve, he's so much more than a super agent. As someone I have known and loved for many years, he is definitely one of those people whose optimism and interest in others leads you to believe he thinks just about anything is possible for anyone. His story is coming up after the break. Coming up with a name for your business can be difficult. Finding a matching domain can be even harder. Don't settle for a website name, you know, that's kind of close. Show strength and brand continuity with a domain name that is the exact match to your business name. .inc offers premium, instantly credible domains built for businesses of all sizes. Startups everywhere are switching to the domain ending that means business, from reset.inc to self.inc. A .inc domain will help put your brand alongside Fortune 500 companies like Facebook, PayPal, and Amazon. .inc is the domain that means business for your business. Establish your online presence by registering your .inc domain today. Visit entrepreneur.inc to learn more. And now, on with the show. We're back. I've always enjoyed talking to Steve, as he seems to know so much about so many things. So, we sat down a few weeks ago to catch up for How Success Happens, and I started out by asking him about his early days and getting into the business he has thrived in.
When I got out of law school, I knew I wasn't going to be a lawyer. I had been told by this partner in a major law firm that I'd worked for my second summer that law wasn't for me. He gave me He gave me the greatest gift. He just crushed me, but in a very kind way. And he set my life in a very different trajectory. And so I ended up getting a job at this company, Athletes and Artists. And then I ended up leaving there and went to another agency. And it was November of 1995, Rob. I just woke up one morning. I was living on 68th Street and Broadway in 1995. And I woke up with a cold. I didn't feel well. And I called my boss, Bob Rosen, RLR Associates. And I said, I'm quitting this job. And he's like, what? Are you sure? He was a really nice guy. And he said, do you want severance? You know, who says that? You know, he's right. A very decent guy. And I said, no, but if you could just pay me through the end of the year and let me keep my office through Christmas. And he said, of course, no problem. And I remember I woke up the next day and I thought, oh my God, what have I done? I just ruined my life. I worked so hard to get to this point. I was making a really good salary. I didn't have any clients to really speak of, but I knew I didn't want to work for people that I didn't have the same philosophy with. It was really very transactional at that agency and the one I worked at before, or I perceived it that way. So I felt better that day, and I walked over to the Reebok Sports Club where I met you, actually.
Yeah, years ago. I mean, that I've been there since now Equinox, since 1999 or 2000. I know that's where we came together. Right. So you walk over there.
So I walk over there, and it's November 1995, and I get in the elevator, and it's a two-flight elevator, but it's a lot longer. They're big flights. And as the elevator door is closing, this gigantic man walks in, like larger than life. He had to be 300 pounds. And what's he doing in an elevator? It wasn't a muscular 300 pounds. And it was this guy named Alfred Geller, who I had met probably 3 or 4 months earlier at a news conference called RTNDA, Radio Television News Directors Association. And I knew he was a big guy in the business, literally and figuratively, because he represented Al Roker, Connie Chung, and Maury Povich, you know, some really big news people. And I don't know what possessed me, but in that moment, I just had this idea and I blurted it out to him in the elevator. I said, "Alfred, my name's Steve Herz. We met a few months ago. I just quit my job yesterday and I want to start my own business. And I'd like to start it with you, because I really know the sports television business now, having worked in it for the past several years, and you know the news business. I think we could do really well together. I don't want to work for anybody anymore. I want to be on my own, but you'd be a great partner." And he must have been like, "Who the hell is this guy?" But to his credit, as we got out of the elevator, he turned back to me and he said, "Here's my card. Be in my office tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. And I went to his office and we decided to become partners. It turned out that he used to eat lunch at the same restaurant every day behind his office. He was at the Fist Building, 200 West 57th Street off Broadway. And behind that is a restaurant called Patsy's. And sure, it's a famous Italian restaurant. Right, exactly.
Sinatra, right? Isn't that really well known? Yeah, I've eaten there before. It's old school.
So I grew up in North Woodbury on Long Island, and my next door neighbor were the Scognamillos, who owned Patsy's in the family for the last 75 years. So Alfred checked me out with the Scognamillos. They gave me the thumbs up, and we became partners. And that lasted for about a year. But I learned more from him in 1 year than from anybody else previous to that, including all my years in law school, college, everything. This guy was obsessed with the communication medium and why someone was good on air and how they could become better on air. And he had hundreds and hundreds of tapes and videos and audio tapes and every aspect of how you could analyze someone on air.
That's amazing.
And that was it.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty amazing. If funny enough, a quick side note, it reminds me, in those same elevators one time, I happened to see this security guard ushering everyone over to one elevator. So of course I'm like, I'm not going in that elevator. I get into another elevator at Reebok, and who is it? It's Madonna. So it's just me, Madonna, and her security guard. And I say to her, "My first concert, Material Girl, Madison Square Garden, 1984. And she just looked at me, didn't really say anything. And that was my Madonna story. Yeah. And then, you know, I kind of was like, I always remember that. But I remember when you were telling me those elevators. So that is incredible. Like, for your story, you just had, you know, the audacity to just say, spur of the moment, just to go for it. And I think that's such an important part of being an entrepreneur, not waiting and waiting and waiting, but eventually you just have to dive in. You dive in, you start this business. So then what happens? Why did it only last a year? It sounds like you learned so much and this guy was so relevant in your career.
Yeah, what happened was, is Alfred was great, but we were partners and I was paying for part of my rent in his office at this Fist Building, and we were sharing the revenue 50-50. And after about a year, I think we brought in $80,000, and I had to give him 40 of that. And he didn't actually have a lot of contacts in the sports business, it turned out. And he thought, because Maury Povich was really good friends with Dan Marino, we'd get Dan Marino as a client, but none of that ever materialized. And I just went to him after a year and I said, "Alfred, look, I can't live on 40,000. I can't even live on 80,000 minus expenses. But if I'm going to make a go of this, I got to try to at least do it on my own." And he was great. You know, he just said, "Good luck, kid, keep in touch." And we did. And I rented an office. It was on my 30th birthday that I officially started IF Management. And I rented an office downtown at 40 Wall Street from my brother's law firm. And that's how the company started in 1996.
So then you're starting the company. You're really on your own at this point. What were you feeling at that time?
I really hope that you hadn't asked that question. No one's ever asked that before. My parents could tell you, I was an absolute wreck. I have never dealt with anything close to that level of anxiety and fear. It was just brutal. I couldn't really imagine doing it. And thankfully, my brother, Arnie, who's still my lawyer, being in that same office with him and his partners who I knew, they gave me a sense of, you know, just calmness that, "Hey, we'll kind of be here for you until you get your training wheels off, and it's going to be okay." And I think after about a month, everything kind of really solidified, and I took a risk. My parents lent me some money and I hired somebody to be, you know, my assistant, so to speak. I never really had an assistant. And you know the guy, it's Lowell Taub.
That's amazing. I never knew that. Who's the Olympic agent right now, right?
Yeah, very proud of that. You know, so Lowell came on board right after he graduated from Cornell in 96. And he was great. And, you know, slowly we built it. And then after about 8 months, I was able to afford getting out of that law firm, that one little office. And I moved up to 888 7th Avenue. And then this guy, Jared Horowitz, who's now the vice chairman of Newmark Realty, he left RLR and joined me. And so the three of us had this business. And then we ended up bringing on Tracy Wolfson. She was my assistant for a year. And look, I've been very lucky. All the people that have ever worked at IF and now the Montag Group, just like, you know, so many of them, just literally the best people in the world.
You've had a lot of, that's funny. I never knew Lowell and that story with him, but knowing him, you know, as a person and what a good guy he is, and knowing a lot of other hires you've had over the years, that's got to be a good feeling when you see them go out and have success. Do you take pride in that, or do you see it as competitive, or how do you handle that?
No, I take it's pure pride and joy. I don't own anybody. Nobody has to work for me for their whole life. We've never had contracts with people. I think people who are good don't want a contract because they know they're not going to get fired and they have, you know, a lot of value. And those are the types of people we've attracted. And so I'm so proud of all of them. You know, Mike Levine was first, he was an intern for us at Athletes and Artists. And then he replaced me when I left. Now he's the president of CAA Sports.
Vino, amazing.
I'm proud of him. Jared, you know, vice chairman at Newmark. Lowell, Lori York, who runs...
Lori, I love Lori. I never wish... Yeah. That's right. She was with you for a while as well.
You know, just Melissa Breen, who's now down in South Carolina. Carol, and all the people that still are with me. Carol Perry, Lowell Taub. I mean Gideon Cohn.
Gideon, been together. Yep.
Carol and Gideon have been with me for over 20 years.
Amazing.
So I think a lot of people have asked me along the way, what is leadership? And I personally think leadership is really finding the right people, and being able to train and retain enough of them that you have a good business.
Yeah. Well,
because it can't be just about you.
It's amazing to see when you say the amount of or the names of some of those folks and people. I've realized, I mean, part of, and I agree as an entrepreneur, the biggest part is hiring the right people. Most likely smarter than you, better than you, at least in my case, at doing certain things, and then being able to motivate them and being able to know how to communicate with them. And I want to get to your book because this talks a lot about that. But I also want to talk about those early stages. And if you can tell me, so you have Lowell in, you have other, was there like a first time, because being an entrepreneur is such a roller coaster, and like that fear and anxiety is so common with everyone starting up, even if they're on their third startup, talking personally. But like when you look back at that time, was there a first moment you were like, you know what? Wow, it was a euphoric moment. You signed someone. What was that moment?
Wow. I would say the first moment that really made me think, okay, we could actually be successful here. We could do this was about four or five months into the starting of the company. ESPN launched this new network called ESPN News in the fall of 96. And I had a good relationship with Al Jaffe, who is the legendary head of talent there, who ended up speaking at the rehearsal dinner at my wedding and roasted me for 20 minutes. But Al was a great guy, very tough, but fair. And they had started this new business and they were hiring 15 anchors for this ESPN News position. And I had signed these two guys right out, two of the first people I ever signed in the company were these two guys in really small markets. One was in Quad City, Iowa, Dave Revson, who's now the main talent at the Big Ten Network, and Chuck Garfine, who was in Traverse City, Michigan, who's now the pre- and post-game host of the Chicago White Sox. And both of those guys got hired, and they went from making like $20,000 to $100,000. And people started calling me and saying, wow, like if you can take these guys from these small markets, what can you do for me? And that's when I sort of realized, okay, we have a chance here.
Now, did a lot of those, that and that talent, like, and it's amazing, you know, still today, you're working with that same talent, let's say, from 20 some odd years ago, right? What would you say at that point, you started getting a lot of calls? Did a lot of the talent not have agents at that time who were in smaller markets? You know, going back, this is like when ESPN's just kind of starting with other networks. Like, was that a key component that you were able to sign a lot of talent because they weren't with agents, or were they just seeing how successful you were in leaving their agents and coming to you?
No, it was mostly the former, mostly that they didn't have agents. I mean, we took chances on people in, like I said, these smaller markets. Also, one of the things that I think helped us is that, and we still do it to this day, we really approach the business differently than many of our competitors. Even back then, we make all these potential clients write a bio about themselves in the third person and really unmask themselves and talk about who you are and why you wanted to get in the business. And so Dave Revson's a good example of that. Al Jaffe, I believe, hired him because Dave had such an amazing backstory. He was a kid who was an amazing student. He graduated with almost a 4.0 at Northwestern. He went on to become a Rotary Scholar, which is just a tiny rung below Rhodes Scholar. He got a perfect score on the GMAT and the LSAT. And he got asked to be in this program at Chase Bank in the 90s, where they were training people to become bankers who had no banking background in college. They just wanted the really smart kids who they thought they could train. And he was making a crazy amount of money down on Wall Street. And he got a call one day, this is way before I met him, of course. He got a call one day from a friend from Northwestern saying there was a job open for a number three sports anchor in Sherman, Texas, making, you know, $8 an hour. And he called his parents up from a payphone. He went all the way down to the street level from the 40th floor he's working on, called on the payphone and said, "Can I borrow the family Honda?" And quit this job and moved to Sherman, Texas. And by the way, he had gotten accepted, I think, at the time to Yale Law School. He was supposed to go next year. And his parents, to their credit, his dad was a very famous professor at Northwestern. They supported him. And he got to Sherman. He was there for a couple of years, met his wife, and then moved to Quad City. And that's when I met him. And I didn't know any of this about him when he sent me the reel. But when I asked him to write that bio and I read that, I said, this is a guy that I want to work with. And I have now for over 25 years. And who wouldn't want to hire someone like that?
No,
you know, with that kind of desire.
It's amazing. I love the stories. I relate to it. Myself graduating, I wanted to be a sportscaster. And I remember I sent my resume reel out to everyone, couldn't land a job anywhere. I went to work at Lehman Brothers. And then after 6 months was like, I want to follow my passion. I want to work in sports, and took a job paying nothing for an agency. And that's how I started my career. But it sounds like to me too, you've followed, did you have a passion for broadcasting, the business? Was that why you eventually, you know, kind of started in that business and then took the plunge with your own business?
I really didn't, actually. I'm not going to lie to you.
Yeah, no.
I'm not one of these kids who grew up wanting to go to Syracuse, Newhouse.
Right.
I didn't, you know, I went to high school in Long Island and I really wanted to be a newspaper reporter. I was the sports editor of my high school newspaper. And I think a lot of kids I went to high school with probably think I'm a sports writer now who lost touch with me. And that's what I wanted to do. And I went off to Michigan to write for the Michigan Daily, which I did. And I worked with Adam Schefter on the Daily. And, you know, to his credit, he's unbelievable. He had just this tenacity and the passion for it that I didn't have. And I quit after my sophomore year. One day I was in the locker room of the Detroit Pistons after a Pistons Celtics game. And I thought, I see how this life ends. I saw the finish line. I saw these guys at 40 and 50 years old making deadline and writing copy. And I said, this isn't what I want. And so I ended up going to law school, and then unfortunately came to the realization. The realization came to me. I wasn't good at that. So that was over. And then when I got to the job at Athletes and Artists, and I didn't even know, Rob, I had no idea broadcasters had agents.
Right,
I didn't know that was
a
thing.
Right.
But then when I started to learn about it and I got to be friendly with Bruce Beck and Bill Walton, and I saw what these guys were doing and how you could help them, I thought, okay, this could be a cool career. And then Alfred Geller was the guy who really lit the match for me, because he loved the details of the business. Like, you're great at your business because you dive into it and you want to know everything about it. And I think passion comes from interest and curiosity, not the other way around. And I think certain people, if you put them in any business, if they get interested in it and get curious about it, they'll learn to love it.
Yeah. But I love, listen, you did that for yourself, because it goes back to you in that elevator. And like you said, you don't know what came over you. But the fact you made that comment to him, sat down with him, really launched you on this incredible journey and your incredible success in the broadcasting, you know, space. So it really shows, just as an entrepreneur, like taking that initiative and thinking about that and what it's become today. Can you talk about how, what you've grown to in terms of IF and then your partnership and now being Montag, and explain kind of that relationship and where you are today with the business?
Yeah, I will. If you don't mind, I want to say one other thing about the elevator. Because I've thought about it. I think that when you, and I don't always do this, but when you come to a relationship and you've internalized a belief, and it could be wrong, by the way, and I think it was wrong on that elevator, but I didn't know enough to know it was wrong. If you internalize a belief that you have really something to offer somebody else, I believed in that moment that I could offer Alfred Geller something really valuable. And I was there to actually help him. I mean, he was 66 years old and a very successful businessman. He didn't need me at all, but I didn't know that in that moment. I wasn't thinking that. I think if you really internalize that, then you won't be afraid and you really have something to offer other people. But going back to your question about where we are now, I mean, what happened was, is, as you know, IF Management has always been a very good business, but it was never really designed for maximum profits. It's not really about how many clients we could sign. It was really much more of a qualitative approach to the types of individuals we were going to represent than a quantitative approach of how much money we're going to make or whatever. So the Dave Revsons and the Dan Schulmans and the people that we've represented, the Matt Yaloffs for so long, these guys are all great friends of mine. Adam Zucker, Liam McHugh, I've known them, Greg Amsinger, for 15, 20 years. If I left the business, they'd still be some of my best friends. And so that was the approach. And then, but at some point, the business started to change. And it's funny being on this podcast with you because it's a little surreal because I've talked to you about this in real time 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago. And you were one of the guys that I think gave me some really good advice along the way about whether I should zig or zag or where to go. And I know you were going through some of the same things. But what I realized is that the small business owner in that very small boutique shop was really under threat in the broadcast space. The big agencies came in, CAA, WME, and they really weren't that interested in my space. And they weren't interested in the B plus, A minus level broadcaster, not the Bob Costas, but the level below. And they got really interested in it. And they started to try to poach our clients and some employees. And they had some success with it. And then Sandy Montag, who, you know, frankly, is like a giant in the business. Growing up in the industry, there was one guy that was the chief of the entire tribe of the entire business. And it was Sandy Montag. And he was always really just a gentleman. He just had an amazing way about him. You know, when all these other guys are trying to steal your clients and it was so cutthroat, Sandy just never did that. In fact, he went out of his way to tell clients, don't leave, Steve, don't leave. If they're good guys, you're being handled well. I mean, who does that? It's almost
unheard
of, right?
Who did Sandy represent? Like, who were some of his?
Madden, Vital, Costas, Jim Nance, James Brown. Like you can go through the entire list of every single person that's been an impact player in the business for the last 30 years. And odds are they were Sandy's clients. So he worked at IMG for 30 years. He ran their media business and their entire representation business. And one day he calls me up out of the blue and he says, hey, I'm leaving IMG. I'm starting my own business and I could do it on my own, but I'd rather have a partner and I like you and we could do it together and it'd be fun. And I said, great. Where do I sign up?
Right.
That was that. And we shook hands on it. And it's been, honestly, it's been almost 4 years and we haven't had one argument. And then we brought Maury Gosfran in about 3 years ago and he's great. Maury and I have known each other forever. And it's like three guys who are friendly.
Yeah, Maury's a legend. I mean, he's been in the business for a long time. I mean, it's so great to see you three guys and doing so well. And you've obviously learned so much. I mean, and you've come across so much talent, dealt with talent. Tell me about, so you decide to write a book, right? Not just any book, because reading through it, and thanks for sending me a copy, it's really insightful. I want you to explain kind of how the idea came about, and then if you can kind of go into the book itself and your thoughts.
Sure. The idea came about when I was turning 50 4 years ago. My birthday is in 5 days, 4 days, July 7th of 66.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. So in January, February or so, March of 2016, as I was about to turn 50, I told my wife I wanted to have a birthday party. So we planned this party on June 16th, which is ironic because my book was launched 4 years to the date after that party. But in the run-up to that party, I just started to have, I don't think a midlife crisis is the right word, but I'll call it a midlife crisis because there's no other thing I can call it. I just knew there was more that I wanted to do with my life. And it was at the same time where I just felt very under attack. This is before I joined with Sandy from these bigger agencies. And I thought, I have a nice business, very stable, secure, but what else do I want to do in my life? What else could I do that I think would be additive to the world? And I thought, well, what do I know? This is the one thing I know. And is there any other application for my knowledge and skill set in another part of the world? And it dawned on me that the coaching that we had done and the feedback we were giving to our broadcaster clients all these years, and I think the ones that took that feedback who were succeeding more than the others, that could be applied to a doctor, a dentist, a lawyer, anybody who had to communicate with people. The other part is that so many people talk about media training and public speaking. What I thought was missing from the world was this idea of private speaking, what we're doing right now, having a dialogue. And I think most of people's success from the communication realm comes from their ability to speak privately with another person. And even if you're an amazing public speaker, 90 to 99% of your communication is still going to be private speaking. So I set about trying to teach this. This is what I wanted. I wanted to teach it. I wanted to think about going into a law school or an undergrad and teaching it. And I mentioned this one day. I put together like a little proposal, like a PowerPoint, which I didn't even know how to use PowerPoint. A guy in my office helped me. And my daughter, who you know, Josie.
I love Josie.
Thank you. She was in the choir at school and they had a concert. And I go to this concert and I'm excited about this idea. And I'm late and I'm in the back row. And I run into a mom at school whose daughter is in the choir too, or maybe it was her son. And her name is Tali Potter. She's the deputy general counsel at this bank called Bank Leumi. And I tell her what I want to do. And she says, I love this idea. I think it's a great idea. I think we need more of this. I think you should come work at my bank. I said, really? So she said, I want to introduce you to the head of HR from my bank. And she did. And Tali Potter is really the person in the world who is most responsible for my book. And she says, I want you to meet the HR head. I meet the HR head. The lady comes to my office and she said, I love this idea. I want to hire you to come coach at Bank Leumi and consult. What do you charge? And her name is Kate Ettinger. And I said, Kate, I don't know because I don't have any clients. I just started this
thing. I love that. I love the honesty.
And she's like, well, what do you think is fair? So I said, well, a good lawyer charges this. What if I charge you that? She said, great, fine, you're hired. So I start working at Bank Leumi. I start giving speeches and coaching some executives there. And then one day they asked me to come give a speech at International Women's Day of all days. They hire a man to come speak. March 8th, 2017, I give this presentation. And this woman named Esther, I don't even know her last name, she gets up after the speech and she says, I love what you had to say. I really want to buy two copies of your book for my children. They're 21 and 19. Where can I buy two copies of your book? I said, Esther, I don't have a book. And she said to me in front of like 150 people, she said, well, that's a real shame because you should write a book. So I came home that night. I tell my wife, who you know well, Raquel. I said,
I love Raquel too. I got to give her a shout out.
Thank you. She deserves it. So I said, Raquel, I was told to write a book. She says, well, you've been keeping notes. You got this idea. Go write a book. I said, it's not that easy. She goes, no. Go write a book right now. Go and start writing. You'll never know. So I went in our kitchen. We have a table there. I take out the laptop or the iPad. I start writing. I wrote four chapters and an outline. And it was just basically from what I was teaching. And the next morning, and look, Rob, you know, life never works out this way. Next morning, I take my kids to school and I run to a mom who's dropping her kids off at school. Her name is Jill Zucker. And she's a partner at McKinsey. And I tell her about the idea. And she said, you have to write this book. It's a great idea. Call my friend Ifat Rice-Gandell at Foundry Media. She does all these kinds of books. She's great. I called her up, come to my office, go to her office. She says, I think this is a combination of Malcolm Gladwell meets Tony Robbins. Now, obviously I'm flattered. I don't really believe it, but whatever.
Sure.
She signs me. Next thing you know, 4 months later, there's a bidding war between three major publishers.
More from our guest, but first, a word from our sponsors.
Hey, it's Robert. It's been a really tough year all around, but like myself, The Hartford believes in the power of the human spirit to overcome adversity. And with the right team, resources, and technology to support them through the difficult times, people are definitely capable of amazing things. And now, more than ever, employee needs are evolving quickly. It's more important than ever to have a partner who stands behind you as you look to make decisions that ensure you are providing the right support for your workforce. The Hartford is dedicated to helping you do that. Their experienced, consultative teams will take the time to get to fully understand your company and help to design a benefits package that provides the best experiences possible for your employees. To learn more about how The Hartford can have your back as you navigate what's next, visit thehartford.com/ future of benefits. That's thehartford.com/future of benefits.
The Hartford is the Hartford Financial Services Group, Inc., and its subsidiaries, including underwriting companies, Hartford Life, an accident insurance company, and Hartford Fire Insurance Company. Home office is Hartford, Connecticut.
And our next sponsor.
As you know, I admire all types of entrepreneurs, but I must admit, I have a special place in my heart for entrepreneurs who aren't only building any old business, but ones focused on social good. Believe in People, a new book by Charles Koch and Brian Hooks, is a surprising take on how you can tackle America's biggest problems from social entrepreneurs who already made their mark, not just in our history books, but in our cities, our schools, and our country's greatest areas of need. Believe in People is an invigorating read that shows exactly how changes happen and how the seemingly small everyday decisions we make can change society for the better. It's why famed investor Mark Andreessen called it a roadmap for solving our country's biggest problems. So get lessons up close from change makers who empowered tens of thousands to escape poverty and inspired thousands more to address their substance abuse and broke through the barriers of partisanship in the process. Pre-order the book today at believeinpeoplebook.com/success. That's believeinpeoplebook.com/success and gain access to bonus content ahead of its November 17th publication.
And we're back.
I love that story. Now, give the concept and the idea behind the book. And, you know, I love the title as well. You can explain that too. But can you tell us about the book and like what the general idea is?
Yeah. So the general idea is based on that there are two things that I think separate people from being good versus great, or being mediocre to being good to great, or reaching your potential or as much as your potential as possible. And there have to be two things present. So first of all, this book is probably not for everybody, but it's for the person who is already doing a lot right. So you have in your bucket, you are a smart person, you are showing up on time, you have good ideas, you're a decent person, you have all that going for you. So you have a lot in your bucket that's already doing well. My point is that there are two other tools that you need to have that you're probably not thinking about having. That's what the book is about, those two tools. The first tool is, are you improving in your life, in your career? And do you have the mindset? You have to have the right mindset. So this book is all about that mindset. The idea is that you probably don't have that mindset. And you don't even know you don't have it. It's a tremendous blind spot for you. And that's why the book is called Don't Take Yes for an Answer. Because what I say is you have to have an aggressive humility about yourself. You have to want to be better. And you're not going to get that feedback from the world anymore. You used to be able to get it, but you don't get it anymore. Because of these three factors. One, grade inflation. Everybody's getting an A or a B. So everybody's doing well. Two, you have this participation trophy that's now morphed into an MVP trophy. So why would you think you should do better? You're already the MVP, right? And third is HR departments, by and large, in American businesses are not giving real constructive feedback to the majority of their employees. They're just telling them they're great and they're not firing anybody anymore. They're downsizing. They're doing reorgs or RIFs. Right? So you don't know what you could be doing better at. You're Rob Tuchman, you're working at AT&T, you went to BU, you got your 3.6, you're doing all these great things. And by the way, you're not getting promoted. And you have no idea why, because you're doing everything well. All the signals are coming back to you positive. So you got to change your mindset. That's the first thing. You got to stop taking yes for an answer because the world is giving you all these yeses. So that's one. The second thing is, what do you need to be improving upon? So assuming you're good enough at your job, you know the job, and showing up on time, et cetera. Why are you not separating from the pack? Why are you in the middle or in the bottom quarter? Why is the other guy at the top? And this is interesting, Rob. What I learned in writing this is that there's a very fascinating study from 1918 that is still applied today that the Carnegie Foundation did, where they interviewed 15,000 engineers and they determined that the causal relationship between your success and how good you are at the technical part of your job, what I call the job, is only 15%. And so I think that means that we all get commoditized. We all get commoditized. If you want to go hire a talent agent to be on TV, you can hire Steve Herz, you can hire Gideon Cohn, you can hire Sandy Montag, you can hire Jim Orenstein or all these other people, but you don't really know who's better because we all seem good. We have a good company. They have a good company. I've been doing it 25 years. He's been doing it 25 years. How do you know? You're judging it based on the 85%. So the book is about the 85%. How do we get better at that? And we might call that the soft skills of life. And what I believe is that we don't understand the soft skills of life. If I was to tell you, Rob Tuckman, you need to improve your soft skills. You need to improve your EQ. Hopefully you look back at me and go, Steve, what the hell does that mean? What am I supposed to work on? So what I'm trying to say to people is, here are some tools and some language and some metrics and some actionable things you can do to identify how good you are at the soft skills, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, and how you can improve them. And that gets to the meat of the idea, which is called AWE, A-W-E. It's this acronym. And it stands for A, authority, W, warmth, E, energy. And ultimately, we hire people and we promote people because we believe, separate and apart from their substantive qualities, we believe that they have competency or a skill or a talent, and they present that stylistically, right? And so that's where the authority comes in. And it gets very granular. Do you have a good voice? Do you speak with a sense of self-assuredness? Do you finish your own sentences? Do you not use filler words to compromise your own authority? Do you not, you know, a lot of people do this. They talk, and when they're making a point to you, their eyes dart away, and they're not making eye contact with you. So you subconsciously think, well, this guy doesn't even believe what he's saying. And you might believe what you're saying, but you've lost your authority in that moment. And we don't teach this in elementary school, high school. We never teach it at all. So people don't know whether they have authority. The second piece is the W, it's warmth. And this is where all relationships are built. Connectivity, trust. That's the most important thing, is trust. If someone's going to get into an Uber, they want to know they can trust the driver. If somebody's going to be in a business relationship with you and hand you over $1 million or their career, they got to trust you. And if you can't communicate with that warmth and be able to connect with them, you're never going to get that business.
That's right.
And a lot of people don't even know that they're making these fatal flaws in not engendering that warmth and trust. And the last piece of it is energy. We want to be around people that make us feel good and make us feel energized. There's a certain dynamic in every relationship. And this is not a one-size-fits-all approach, because guys like you and me are very high energy. And I think we do a pretty good job of energizing people. But there are people out there who are not high energy, and yet they also can be very energizing in their own way. But you got to figure out for yourself how to make that work. And those are the soft skills. And those are the people that I have seen along the way that really succeed to the fullest in life. And that's what the book is about.
I mean, I love the concept. I love the idea, because I'm a true believer as well in terms of communication and warmth. And some of the things you're saying really resonate with me, just how, you know, I've seen people who are successful, and you see some of these things. And now, you know, I understand that. But two things. One is, first off, how are you measuring success? What does that mean? Does that mean higher pay? Does that, like, when you look at these people and if they implement some of these kind of practices, what is real success? Because I've seen there's people who have none of what you just explained, but for some reason, I see them as they're the CEO of some business. Maybe not CEO, but there's some successful people if you just based it on dollars, let's say. But like,
yeah. Well, I don't base it just on dollars. And also, those people, even the successful people who don't have these all qualities, I would argue that if they had those all qualities, they would be CEO. And
right.
Even if they're CEO, they would be even better at their job. So the question is really, you make a good point about success. I'm not suggesting my definition of success should be yours. I'm only saying that the person who reads this book should be someone who wants to reach a greater degree of their potential that they're reaching right now. And look, that might not mean any more money for you, but it might mean more free time. It might just mean that because you become a better communicator, you become a better little league manager. And that's important. Maybe you become a better parent because of it. So you have to define success for yourself. But I do think in a lot of cases, there are people out there that are frustrated because they're making X and they know they're capable of making 2X or 3X. And they're sabotaging themselves with these things. So for them, that would be a measure of success if they could double or triple their income. And I do think they could.
How do you get better, obviously, at warmth and energy? Like, are those things you can, to me, sometimes I think, oh, maybe that's just innate. People are either warm or they're not, you know, they're like, are those things you've seen people are able to work on and authentically really implement them into their being?
I have, because, you know, you read the book, so you know, I think it's like anything else, Rob. I love, one of my big jokes with you all these years has been the double dribbling. You know, you use that thing with the two. Rob dribbles two basketballs at a time for dexterity. And you've become a much better ball handler because of it, right? And so I think anybody, yeah,
maybe a drop, but still not good. But anyway,
but anybody can. But yes. anyone can improve anything. And if you think about life, whatever aspect of study it is, if you can break something down into a smaller components, then you can improve it once you understand it. It's like a quarterback taking a three-step drop. If you understand the mechanics of the three-step drop and you bring it down into that little small detail, you can improve upon it. And I think that's the same thing with authority, warmth, and energy. So that's what I try to do in this book, is really break it down for people, saying, don't look at warmth and authority as these kind of amorphous, you know, hard to understand concepts. Let's get into the granularity of it, the tiny little details. And so I'll give you an example of myself. I have a problem. I don't smile enough, right? I got my teeth knocked out playing racquetball years ago, and I've always been very sensitive about my teeth. And to this day, Raquel makes fun of me. Hey, you're out there coaching people how to be warmer, smile more. But you can smile more. And there are tricks that you can learn how to smile more. And I have improved. Another thing is, folding your arms is a manifestation of a body language that doesn't make people feel like you're welcoming them. And that's just a behavioral thing that can be changed.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And it doesn't make you any less authentic if you make eye contact with someone when you're talking to them, or you smile more when you're talking to them, or you don't use filler words because you've broken a bad habit. So I definitely think they can be coached. However, I will concede to you one thing, which is that there are people that are naturally better at these things than other people. I'm never going to have the same voice as James Earl Jones. That's just not going to happen. But that's okay. We just want to be a better version of ourselves. That's all I'm hoping people get out of this.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And when I said success and realizing it just all of that, from authority, warmth, energy, like in every part of your life, in everything you do, that is going to make you better and really connect more with people, which is the ultimate of what we all want. And I want to shift gears a little bit now in the time we have left. You represent all these broadcasters. We're at a time I don't think any of us have ever seen, and both of us living through, not to compare, but like 9/11, great financial crisis here in New York City. Like this pandemic, how is that affecting these broadcasters, your business? Like there's no sports right now. I mean, it's coming back, right? We're starting to play baseball and hockey and basketball. And how has that affected your business?
Well, it's affected it because right now with no real sports, some of our clients have lost their jobs. The Golf Channel in particular really downsized quite a bit. Some of our clients have been asked to take pay cuts, and some of them have been asked voluntarily, and every one of them, I think almost everyone, maybe one person didn't, but everybody took the pay cuts. So people are pitching in. I find there's been a tremendous amount of goodwill, really a lot of goodwill on both sides of the table. These big companies, some of them have said, hey, look, we're struggling here. Can you help us out? And everybody has. So look, it just depends on how much longer this lasts. I think we're going to be okay. I really do. And I think ultimately at some point, we're either going to get to some level of herd immunity, or there's going to be a vaccine, or the hospitals will be able to withstand more, or we'll have some kind of a hybrid where you'll have football, but no fans, or basketball, no fans. And obviously there's a lot of anxiety for myself and others right now, but we'll withstand it. And most of our clients financially are smart. They've saved money, and this is their kind of rainy day fund. Maybe some of them have to dip into a 401k or whatever, but they've been pretty good. I haven't had almost anybody say, holy cow, I can't feed my family, luckily. But I do think at the other end of this, a lot of positive will come of it. I really do. I've compared this to the Industrial Revolution. I think there's going to be a lot more efficiency in the world, where people aren't going to have to commute the 2 hours to go to work every day, at least 5 days a week. And unfortunately, maybe Howard Stern's ratings will go down on Sirius, but
well, hope, you know, not. People, then podcasting is going to go down. We don't want that.
Right, exactly. But, you know, but I think even still the strong will survive like you. But I just think that every crisis has been met with some level of ingenuity that nobody saw in the moment, but it's going to be there.
Well, you look back in like in the financial crisis, and we've had on our show, you know, I'm just thinking Alexia Brew from Welling, created Well and Good out of like right around that time of the financial crisis, when people are forced to think what they're going to do, what's important. Look at all those businesses that started then, like Uber. So I also agree with you. I think there's going to be a lot of ingenuity. My only thing that I'd love to get your thoughts on, just because I know you and you're such a great thinker, is, like you said, like, I think that people need connection. I think humans need this contact. There's only so much, like me and you, we were going to do this live, right? And then we're like, let's just do it on Zoom. And I'm just a big believer that that human connection is so important. So I don't want to see people stuck in their homes on computer screens. Like, I just don't think that's good for people's mental health. Maybe I'm wrong, because I bet the majority of people are like, I'd love to work from home. And I get that to some point. And I think that companies now realize you can do that to a degree. But do you think it's really going to, like you said, industrial revolution, do you think that there's really going to be a major, major change? And will that last?
It's a great question. And the honest answer is I don't know. But I think it's going to be some level of middle ground. I don't think companies are going to be able to hire new people, even the Facebooks and the Googles and the Twitters that have been very aggressive, for lack of a better word, or progressive, if you will, in telling their employees, you never have to come back to the office. And that's fine for a community of people that already know each other, but you can't build that level of community and connectivity if you're onboarding new people. And ultimately, a year, two, three, 4 years from now, Twitter's going to have a lot of turnover because there's a natural attrition in any business. And you've got 30% new people that don't know each other. That's going to be really impossible. So I think you're not going to have to come to the office every day, but people will come 2-3 days a week, maybe 4 days a week, maybe sometimes 5 days a week. But I think the idea of not having to come in every day and still being efficient with your time and still being productive. Ultimately, think about this, Rob. If you can free up from the average person, let's just use an hour commute each way, 2 hours a day, and they don't have to commute, let's say 2 days a week, 4 hours, and you multiply 4 hours times 300 million people, right? And you get 1.2 billion new, if I did my math right, probably more, but 1.2
whatever,
billion.
Whatever, it's a lot.
new productivity possible hours. Now, some people are going to waste that time watching Netflix, whatever. But hopefully some of that time is going to be used to invent new products and create new things. And that's where I think this new level of ingenuity and inventiveness is going to come from.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. It's not going to be, nobody's going to ever go to the office.
No, it's just, it's interesting because it's like some might say, you know, like there might be more people who love it because they are watching more Netflix and they miss that just general interaction when they get inspiration by walking into someone's office and all of a sudden this idea pops. But I do agree with you. I think it's a hybrid approach going forward. And I think the biggest thing is employers now are going to understand that, you know what, some of my employees or the majority of my employees, they can be productive, you know, and they're not so fearful of them not being in the office. So I think that will be a positive. I'm just curious, like, if these companies change their policies once they have a bad quarter, bad numbers, you know, like we've seen it go back and forth, but well, obviously,
you're right.
We're going to see what happens.
I think it also depends on the business. With our team at our company, it's very easy to see who's doing well and who's not. You know, it's not just sales in terms of client deals done, but it's also who's got deal flow and who's recruiting people and how many people are you getting in the room with. So I don't know if other businesses have similar metrics, but if they do, and you have an employee who's just really his productivity has dropped off because of this new reality, then you're probably not going to want either that person to work for you.
Yeah,
or you're going to bring it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it used to be you have employees there and I'm going back in the day starting my first business. And like, you know, we had a lot of people, young people, and it was like, you just had to be there to watch over them to make sure they were doing something. Because if you didn't, but then maybe you got the wrong people. So
I agree with you completely.
You know, so it's really interesting how that works. So moving ahead for you, you've been such a staple and like pioneer to a degree in this business. And you know, I've always loved your business because you have such good quality clients in so many different areas. And there's been so many jobs within broadcasting. It's just grown as you've grown as well. For you personally, what, as you said, you wrote this book, do you want to be doing this for the long term? Do you see yourself like, you're such an interesting guy. Do you see yourself maybe wanting to do other things as well? Get more into kind of the teaching or what's next for Steve Herz?
Well, I've been really lucky. I've had the ability over the last 3 years to do both things. I've had really taken on too many clients in the last 3 years. So my client list has been basically the same for the last 25 years, as you know. You know a lot of these guys. And so I'm servicing those people, and we have such close relationships, and I think I'm still doing a good job for them. And then I'm overseeing the people in my company and growing. Like, I'm most proud of the fact that we got this guy, Michael Solins, who came to us from also out of Cornell, and he was struggling as an agent in our business. And we transferred him to a marketing position, and he's killing it now. And we had this guy, Reed Pakula, joined us about 3-4 years ago, who struggled a little bit in the beginning. And he's in the book, actually, and he's killing it now. And Gideon, as you know, Gideon Cohen is thriving, and Carol Perry's thriving. And we hired a guy named Kevin Belby that we brought on about 5 years ago, and he's killing it too. So I'm proud of those guys, and I want to nurture more of the younger people in our office. And now with Sandy and Maury, we have about 20 people. So that's kind of where I feel like my input can be. And again, that's more of a qualitative thing. It's not an every day, every hour thing. And then on the other side, I am really enjoying the thought behind the book and the message behind it. And I'm doing a lot of marketing for it. And I've actually been doing quite a bit of coaching, both for Bank Leumi, and I got hired by a place called Guggenheim Partners. And I spoke at a law firm, Wilkie Farr Gallagher, recently. And other companies are coming at me and asking me to do stuff. So as long as I have time to do everything, I want to do it. And I'm not taking on more than I can handle. My definition of success, again, is not just how much business I can get. It's just wanting to deal with a very small, select group of people who I like and are good people. And the people at Bank Leumi are amazing. And the people at Guggenheim are amazing. And I love working with them because they treat me like a partner, even though I'm not a partner. And the same thing with my colleagues at work and with Sandy and Maury and Gideon and the whole crew. That's what I'm looking for, just to enhance those kinds of relationships.
And you just, and I agree with you at this stage and really myself as well, it's much more about every day and enjoying every day and working with people you really want to work with. And that to me is what success is. And if you're able to do that, be grateful for all the things that you have and family and whether it's just, you know, in these times, food and shelter. But like, really, I do think, like, and I've learned, to be happy, it's about people. It's about who you're working with day in, day out. You know, when I was younger, it was about chasing. And I've really, over this Corona time, I've really, you know, had a chance to think much more about that. And I think that to me, what you just said there really kind of sums up what's important. It's so great to see you doing all of these things, and I wish you much success. The book, can you tell us again the title, and just so people can order their copy ASAP?
Sure. It's called Don't Take Yes for an Answer, published by HarperCollins Business. And it's available at any bookstore. You can order it anywhere you want, or just go online at Amazon.com, obviously, BarnesandNoble.com. Or if you want, for your readers, I've also published a lot recently, writing about the book, et cetera, at www.stevenherz.com. And with one click, they can order it through that as well.
Cool. I'm hoping that after this podcast, some kid approaches you in an elevator and says, "Hey, Steve, I want to be a partner. I want to work with you." And I'm curious, you know, what will happen. But knowing you, I'm sure from like that experience with Alfred and like knowing that, it's great to see now you, time goes quick, right? But it's great to see you now in that role, because I'm sure there's a lot of kids who would love to be in your position now and are also thinking they have a lot to offer. And I know you've trained and mentored so many successful people that hopefully there's another kid listening to this podcast that sees you one day and you give them that opportunity, or her.
Well, thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me on. And one last thing, I forgot to give a shout out to another colleague of mine, Jeff Feldman, who's also been with us 15 years and like a right hand to me in many respects with a lot of the research behind the book. So you nailed it. And it's just been, honestly, it's great to be on the show with a guy who I love and respect, and I've known you for so long.
Yeah.
I feel like we're very much connected in our philosophies of life, and it's been really enjoyable to be able to talk about that today.
Yeah, well, I missed the daily chats at Equinox. I don't know when that's going to start again, unfortunately, but hopefully I'll be seeing you a bit more when things get a little bit better, and keep doing what you're doing. It's great to see you out there and teaching a lot of people and spreading your wisdom. And I've always looked at you as a guy who's just incredibly bright and had so much interest. And also, you know, you were, I forgot to say for our audience, you were the human LinkedIn before LinkedIn, as I say. You knew, everyone knows Steve Herz. It's incredible. I love that every time. I always giggle and laugh. And whenever I meet anyone in all around, and they always seem to know you and you know them. So it is great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you.
And that's our episode. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to How Success Happens wherever you get your podcasts. We come out with a new episode every Wednesday morning, and you don't want to miss it. And if you like to share, please feel free to pass along the show to an entrepreneur friend who could use a boost, and I could always use the subscribers. And do you have ideas for guests? I always love to hear about great entrepreneurs. If you know anyone, shoot me an email at hsh@entrepreneur.com. or on Twitter at Robert Tuchman, that's RobertTuchman, or even send me a message on LinkedIn. How Success Happens is a production of Entrepreneur Media. Be sure to visit entrepreneur.com for insight on building your business, or even better yet, subscribe to our magazine. No joke, I found my first job after reading about a company in Entrepreneur Magazine back in the 1990s. It's always been my absolute favorite magazine for entrepreneurs. Thanks for listening and spending some time with me today. Until next time, my name is Robert Tuchman, just a fellow entrepreneur and your host. See you soon.